From within the camp she saw King Orin riding toward them, at the head of a massive train of nobles, courtiers, functionaries, major and minor, advisers, assistants, servants, men-at-arms, and a plethora of other species she did not bother identifying. While from the west, rapidly descending on outstretched wings, she saw Saphira. Girding herself for the loud tedium about to engulf them, she said, "It may be some months before I have the opportunity to accept your offer, Blodgarm, but I appreciate it nevertheless. I would enjoy the distraction of a game after the work of a long day. For the present, however, it must remain a deferred pleasure. The entire weight of human society is about to crash down upon you. I suggest you prepare yourselves for an avalanche of names, questions, and requests. We humans are a curious lot, and none of us have seen so many elves before."
"We are prepared for this, Lady Nessawada," said Blodgarm.
As King Orin's thundering cavalcade drew near, and Saphira prepared to land, flattening the grass with the wind from her wings, Nasawada's last thought was,
"Oh, dear. I'll have to put a battalion around Blodgarm to keep him from being torn apart by the women in the camp. And even that might not solve the problem."
Mercy, Dragon Rider. It was mid-afternoon, the day after they had left Eastcroft, when Aragorn sensed the patrol of 15 soldiers ahead of them. He mentioned it to Arya, and she nodded.
"I noticed them as well."
Neither he nor she voiced any concerns, but worry began to gnaw at Aragorn's belly, and he saw how Arya's eyebrows lowered into a fierce frown. The land around them was open and flat, devoid of any cover. They had encountered groups of soldiers before, but always in the company of other travellers. Now they were alone on the faint trail of a road. "We could dig a hole with magic, cover the top with brush and hide in it until they leave," said Aragorn. Arya shook her head without breaking stride.
"What would we do with the excess dirt? They'd think they had discovered the biggest badger den in existence. Besides, I would rather save our energy for running."
Aragorn grunted.
"I'm not sure how many more miles I have left in me."
He was not winded, but the relentless pounding was wearing him down. His knees hurt, his ankles were sore, his left big toe was red and swollen, and blisters continued to break out on his heels, no matter how tightly he bound them. The previous night he had healed several of the aches and pains troubling him, and while that had provided a measure of relief, the spells only exacerbated his exhaustion. The patrol was visible as a plume of dust for half an hour before Aragorn was able to make out the shapes of the men and the horses at the base of the yellow cloud. Since he and Arya had keener eyesight than most humans, it was unlikely the horsemen could see them at that distance, so they continued to run for another 10 minutes. Then they stopped. Arya removed her skirt from her pack and tied it over the leggings she wore while running, and Aragorn stored Brom's ring in his own pack and smeared dirt over his right palm to hide his silvery Gedwe Ignazia. They resumed their journey with bowed heads, hunched shoulders, and dragging feet. If all went well, the soldiers would assume they were just another pair of refugees. Although Aragorn could feel the rumble of approaching hoofbeats and hear the cries of the men driving their steeds, it still took the better part of an hour for their two groups to meet on the vast plain. When they did, Aragorn and Arya moved off the road and stood looking down between their feet. Aragorn caught a glimpse of horse legs from under the edge of his brow as the first few riders pounded past, but then the choking dust billowed over him, obscuring the rest of the patrol. The dirt in the air was so thick he had to close his eyes. Listening carefully, he counted until he was sure that more than half the patrol had gone by.
"They're not going to bother questioning us," he thought.
His elation was short-lived. A moment later, someone in the swirling blizzard of dust shouted, "Company, halt!" A chorus of "Whoa's!" "Steady there's!" and "Hey there, Nels!" rang out as the 15 men coaxed their mounts to form a circle around Aragorn and Arya. before the soldiers completed their manoeuvre and the air cleared. Aragorn pawed the ground for a large pebble, then stood back up.
"Be still,"
hissed Arya. While he waited for the soldiers to make their intentions known, Aragorn strove to calm his racing heart by rehearsing the story he and Arya had concocted to explain their presence so close to the border with Surda. His efforts failed, for notwithstanding his strength, his training, the knowledge of the battles he had won, and the half-dozen wards protecting him, his flesh remained convinced that imminent injury or death awaited him. His gut twisted, his throat constricted, and his limbs were light and unsteady.
"Oh, get on with it," he thought. He longed to tear something apart with his hands, as if an act of destruction would relieve the pressure building inside of him. But the urge only heightened his frustration, for he dared not move. The one thing that steadied him was Arya's presence. He would sooner cut off a hand than have her consider him a coward. And although she was a mighty warrior in her own right, he still felt the desire to defend her. The voice that had ordered the patrol to halt again issued forth.
"Let me see your faces!"
Raising his head, Aragorn saw a man sitting before them on a roan charger, his gloved hands folded over the pommel of his saddle. Upon his upper lip, there sprouted an enormous curly moustache that, after descending to the corners of his mouth, extended a good 9 inches in either direction and was in stark contrast to the straight hair that fell to his shoulders. How such a massive piece of sculpted foliage supported its own weight puzzled Aragorn, especially since it was dull and lustreless, and obviously had not been impregnated with warm beeswax. The other soldiers held spears pointed at Aragorn and Arya. So much dirt covered them, it was impossible to see the flames stitched on their tunics.
"Now then," said the man, and his moustache wobbled like an unbalanced set of scales. "Who are you? Where are you going? And what is your business in the king's lands?"
Then he waved a hand.
"No, don't bother answering. It doesn't matter. Nothing matters nowadays. The world is coming to an end, and we waste our days interrogating peasants. Bah! Superstitious vermin who scurry from place to place, devouring all the food in the land, and reproducing at a ghastly rate. At my family's estate near Urubain, we would have the likes of you flogged if we caught you wandering around without permission. And if we learned that you had stolen from your master, why then we'd hang you. Whatever you want to tell me is lies. It always is. What have you got in that pack of yours, eh? Food and blankets, yes. But maybe a pair of gold candlesticks, eh? Silverware from the locked chest? Secret letters for the Varden? Eh? Cat got your tongue? Well, we'll soon sort the matter out. Langwood, why don't you see what treasures you can excavate from yonder knapsack? There's a good boy." Aragorn staggered forward, as one of the soldiers struck him across the back with the haft of a spear. He had wrapped his armour in rags to keep the pieces from rubbing against each other. The rags, however, were too thin to entirely absorb the force of the blow, and muffled the clang of metal. "Aho!" exclaimed the man with the moustache.
Grabbing Aragorn from behind, the soldier unlaced the top of his pack and pulled out his hauberk, saying,
"Look, sir!"
The man with the moustache broke out in a delighted grin.
"Armour! And of fine make as well. Very fine, I should say. Well, you are full of surprises. Going to join the Varden, were you? Intent on treason and sedition, hmm?"
His expression soured. "Or are you one of those who generally give honest soldiers a bad name? If so, you are a most incompetent mercenary. You don't even have a weapon. Was it too much trouble to cut yourself a staff or a club, eh? Well, how about it? Answer me."
"No, sir."
"No, sir? Didn't occur to you, I suppose. It's a pity we have to accept such slow-minded wretches. But that's what this blasted war has reduced us to, scrounging for leftovers.
Accept me where, sir?
Silence, you insolent rascal! No one gave you permission to speak!
His mustache quivering, the man gestured. Red lights exploded across Aragon's field of vision as the soldier behind him bashed him on the head.
Whether you are a thief, a traitor, a mercenary, or merely a fool, your fate will be the same. Once you swear the oath of service, you will have no choice but to obey Galbatorix and those who speak for him. We are the first army in history to be free of dissent. No mindless blathering about what we should do. Only orders, clear and direct. You too shall join our cause, and you shall have the privilege of helping to make real the glorious future our great king has foreseen. As for your lovely companion, there are other ways she can be of use to the Empire, eh? Now tie them up.
Aragorn knew then what he had to do. Glancing over, he found Arya already looking at him, her eyes hard and bright. He blinked once. She blinked in return. His hand tightened around the pebble. Most of the soldiers Aragorn had fought on the burning plains had possessed certain rudimentary wards, intended to shield them from magical attacks, and he suspected these men were likewise equipped. He was confident he could break or circumvent any spells Galbatorix's magicians invented, but it would require more time than he now had. Instead, he cocked his arm, and with a flick of his wrist, threw the pebble at the man with the mustache. The pebble punctured the side of his helm. Before the soldiers could react, Aragorn twisted around, yanked the spear from the hands of the man who had been tormenting him, and used it to knock him off his horse. As the man landed, Aragorn stabbed him through the heart, breaking the blade of the spear on the metal plates of the soldier's gambeson. Releasing the spear, Aragorn dove backward, his body parallel with the ground as he passed underneath seven spears that were flying toward where he had been. The lethal shafts seemed to float above him as he fell. The instant Aragorn had released the pebble, Arya bounded up the side of the horse nearest her, jumping from stirrup to saddle, and kicked the head of the oblivious soldier who was perched on the mare. He went hurtling more than 30 feet. Then Arya leaped from the back of horse to horse, killing the soldiers with her knees, her feet, and her hands in an incredible display of grace and balance. Jagged rocks tore at Aragorn's stomach as he tumbled to a stop. Grimacing, he sprang upright. Four soldiers who had dismounted confronted him with drawn swords. They charged. Dodging to the right, he caught the first soldier's wrist as the man swung his sword and punched him in the armpit. The man collapsed and was still. Aragorn dispatched his next opponents by twisting their heads until their spines snapped. The fourth soldier was so close by then, running at him with sword held high, Aragorn could not evade him. Trapped, he did the one thing he could. He struck the man in the chest with all his might. A fount of blood and sweat erupted as his fist connected. The blow staved in the man's ribs and propelled him more than a dozen feet over the grass, where he fetched up against another corpse. Aragorn gasped and doubled over, cradling his throbbing hand. Four of his knuckles were disjointed and white cartilage showed through his mangled skin. Blast! He thought as hot blood poured from the wounds. His fingers refused to move when he ordered them to. He realized that his hand would be useless until he could heal it. Fearing another attack, he looked around for Arya and the rest of the soldiers. The horses had scattered. Only three soldiers remained alive. Arya was grappling with two of them some distance away, while the third and final soldier fled south along the road. Gathering his strength, Aragorn pursued him. As he narrowed the gap between them, the man began to plead for mercy, promising he would tell no one about the massacre and holding out his hands to show they were empty. When Aragorn was within arm's reach, the man veered to the side and then a few steps later changed direction again, darting back and forth across the countryside like a frightened jackrabbit. All the while, the man continued to beg, tears streaming down his cheeks, saying that he was too young to die, that he had yet to marry and father a child, that his parents would miss him, and that he had been pressed into the army, and this was only his fifth mission. And why couldn't Aragorn leave him alone? What have you against me?
he sobbed. I only did what I had to. I'm a good person.
Aragorn paused and forced himself to say, You can't keep up with us. We can't leave you. You'll catch a horse and betray us.
No, I won't.
People will ask what happened here. Your oath to Galbatorix and the Empire won't let you lie.
I'm sorry, but I don't know how to release you from your bond, except...
Why are you doing this? You're a monster!
Screamed the man. With an expression of pure terror, he made an attempt to dash around Aragorn and return to the road. Aragorn overtook him in less than 10 feet, and as the man was still crying and asking for clemency, Aragorn wrapped his left hand around his neck and squeezed. When he relaxed his grip, the soldier fell across his feet, dead. Bile coated Aragorn's tongue as he stared down at the man's slack face.
Whenever we kill a part of ourselves, he thought.
Shaking with a combination of shock, pain, and self-loathing, he walked back to where the fight had begun. Arya was kneeling beside a body, washing her hands and arms with water from a tin flask one of the soldiers had been carrying.
How is it? Asked Arya. You could kill that man, but you could not bring yourself to lay a finger on Sloane.
She stood and faced him, her gaze frank. Devoid of emotion, he shrugged. He was a threat. Sloane wasn't. Isn't it obvious? Arya was quiet for a while.
It ought to be, but it isn't. I am ashamed to be instructed in morality by one with so much less experience. Perhaps I have been too certain, too confident of my own choices.
Aragorn heard her speak, but the words meant nothing to him, as his gaze drifted over the corpses.
Is this all my life has become? He wondered. A never-ending series of battles?
I feel like a murderer.
I understand how difficult this is, said Arya. Remember, Aragorn, you have experienced only a small part of what it means to be a dragon rider. Eventually, this war will end, and you will see that your duties encompass more than violence. The riders were not just warriors. They were teachers, healers, and scholars.
His jaw muscles knotted for a moment.
Why are we fighting these men, Arya? Because they stand between us and Galbatorix.
Then we should find a way to strike at Galbatorix directly.
None exist. We cannot march to Urubain until we defeat his forces. And we cannot enter his castle until we disarm almost a century's worth of traps, magical and otherwise.
There has to be a way, he muttered. He remained where he was as Arya strode forward and picked up a spear. But when she placed the tip of the spear under the chin of a slain soldier and thrust it into his skull, Aragorn sprang toward her and pushed her away from the body.
What are you doing?
He shouted. Anger flashed across Arya's face.
I will forgive that only because you are distraught and not of your right mind. Think, Aragorn, it is too late in the day for anyone to be coddling you. Why is this necessary?
The answer presented itself to him. And he grudgingly said,
If we don't, the Empire will notice that most of the men were killed by hand. Exactly. The only ones capable of such a feat are elves, riders, and Kull. And since even an imbecile could figure out a Kull was not responsible for this, they'll soon know we are in the area. And in less than a day, Thorn and Murtagh will be flying overhead, searching for us.
There was a wet squelch as she pulled the spear out of the body. She held it out to him until he accepted it.
I find this as repulsive as you do, so you might as well make yourself useful and help.
Aragorn nodded. Then Arya scavenged a sword, and together they set out to make it appear as if a troop of ordinary warriors had killed the soldiers. It was grisly work, but it went quickly, for they both knew exactly what kinds of wounds the soldier should have, to ensure the success of the deception, and neither of them wished to linger. When they came to the man whose chest Aragorn had destroyed, Arya said,
There's little we can do to disguise an injury like that. We will have to leave it as is, and hope people assume a horse stepped on him.
They moved on. The last soldier they dealt with was the commander of the patrol. His mustache was now limp and torn, and had lost most of its former splendor. After enlarging the pebble hole so it more closely resembled the triangular pit left by the spike of a warhammer, Aragon rested for a moment, contemplating the commander's sad mustache. Then said,
"He was right, you know."
"About what?"
"I need a weapon. A proper weapon. I need a sword."
Wiping his palms on the edge of his tunic, he surveyed the plain around them, counting the bodies.
"That's it then, isn't it? We're done."
He went and collected his scattered armor, rewrapped it in cloth and returned it to the bottom of his pack. Then he joined Arya on the low hillock she had climbed.
"We had best avoid the roads from now on," she said. "We cannot risk another encounter with Galbatorix's men."
Indicating his deformed right hand, which stained his tunic with blood, she said,
"You should tend to that before we set forth."
She gave him no time to respond, but grasped his paralyzed fingers and said,
"We say heal."
An involuntary groan escaped him as his fingers popped back into their sockets, and as his abraded tendons and crushed cartilage regained the fullness of their proper shapes, and as the flaps of skin hanging from his knuckles again covered the raw flesh below. When the spell ended, he opened and closed his hand to confirm that it was fully cured.
"Thank you," he said.
It surprised him that she had taken the initiative when he was perfectly capable of healing his own wounds. Arya seemed embarrassed. Looking away out over the plains, she said,
"I am glad you were by my side today, Aragorn."
"And you by mine." She favored him with a quick, uncertain smile. They lingered on the hillock for another minute, neither of them eager to resume their journey. Then Arya sighed and said,
"We should be off. The shadows lengthen, and someone else is bound to appear and raise a hue and cry when they discover this crow's feast."
Abandoning the hillock, they oriented themselves in a southwesterly direction, angling away from the road, and loped out across the uneven sea of grass. Behind them, the first of the carrion eaters dropped from the sky. Shadows of the Past. That night, Aragorn sat staring at their meager fire, chewing on a dandelion leaf. Their dinner had consisted of an assortment of roots, seeds, and greens that Arya had gathered from the surrounding countryside. Eaten uncooked and unseasoned, they were hardly appetizing. But he had refrained from augmenting the meal with a bird or rabbit, of which there was an abundance in the immediate vicinity, for he did not wish Arya to regard him with disapproval. Moreover, after their fight with the soldiers, the thought of taking another life, even an animal's, sickened him. It was late, and they would have to get an early start the next morning. But he made no move to retire, nor did Arya. She was situated at right angles to him, her legs pulled up with her arms wrapped around them, and her chin resting on her knees, the skirt of her dress spread outward, like the wind-battered petals of a flower. His chin sunk low against his chest. Aragorn massaged his right hand with his left, trying to dispel a deep-seated ache.
"I need a sword," he thought. "Short of that, I could use some sort of protection for my hands, so I don't cripple myself whenever I hit something. The problem is, I'm so strong now I would have to wear gloves with several inches of padding, which is ridiculous. They would be too bulky, too hot. And what's more, I can't go around with gloves on for the rest of my life."
He frowned. Pushing the bones of his hand out of their normal positions, he studied how they altered the play of light over his skin, fascinated by the malleability of his body.
"And what happens if I get in a fight while I'm wearing bronze ring? It's of elvish make, so I probably don't have to worry about breaking the sapphire. But if I hit anything with the ring on my finger, I won't just dislocate a few joints. I'll splinter every bone in my hand. I might not even be able to repair the damage."
He tightened his hands into fists and slowly turned them from side to side, watching the shadows deepen and fade between his knuckles. I could invent a spell that would stop any object that was moving at a dangerous speed from touching my hands. No, wait, that's no good. What if it was a boulder? What if it was a mountain? I'd kill myself trying to stop it. Well, if gloves and magic won't work, I'd like to have a set of the dwarves Askudgamun, their fists of steel. With a smile, he remembered how the dwarf Shurgnain had a steel spike threaded into a metal base that was embedded in each of his knuckles, excluding those on his thumbs. The spikes allowed Shurgnain to hit whatever he wanted with little fear of pain, and they were convenient, too, for he could remove them at will. The concept appealed to Aragorn, but he was not about to start drilling holes in his knuckles. Besides, he thought, my bones are thinner than dwarf bones, too thin, perhaps, to attach the base and still have the joints function as they should. So Askudgamun are a bad idea. But maybe instead I can... Bending low over his hands, he whispered, Thefathun. The backs of his hands began to crawl and prickle, as if he had fallen into a patch of stinging nettles. The sensation was so intense and so unpleasant, he longed to jump up and scratch himself as hard as he could. With an effort of will, he stayed where he was and watched as the skin on his knuckles bulged, forming a flat, whitish callus half an inch thick over each joint. They reminded him of the horn-like deposits that appear on the inside of horses' legs. When he was pleased with the size and density of the knobs, he released the flow of magic and set about exploring by touch and sight the mountainous new terrain that loomed over his fingers. His hands were heavier and stiffer than before, but he could still move his fingers through their full range of motion. It may be ugly, he thought, rubbing the rough protuberances on his right hand against the palm of his left, and people may laugh and sneer if they notice, but I don't care, for it will serve its purpose and may keep me alive. Brimming with silent excitement, he struck the top of a domed rock that rose out of the ground between his legs. The impact jarred his arm and produced a muted thud, but caused him no more discomfort than it would have to punch a board covered with several layers of cloth. Emboldened, he retrieved Brom's ring from his pack and slipped on the cool gold band, checking that the adjacent callus was higher than the face of the ring. He tested his observation by again ramming his fist against the rock. The only resulting sound was that of dry, compacted skin colliding with unyielding stone. "What are you doing?" asked Arya, peering at him through a veil of her black hair. "Nothing." Then he held out his hands. "I thought it would be a good idea, since I'll probably have to hit someone again." Arya studied his knuckles. "You are going to have difficulty wearing gloves."
"I can always cut them open to make room."
She nodded and returned to gazing at the fire. Aragorn leaned back on his elbows and stretched out his legs, content that he was prepared for whatever fights might await him in the immediate future. Beyond that he dared not speculate, for if he did, he would begin to ask himself how he and Saphira could possibly defeat Murtagh or Galbatorix, and then panic would sink its icy claws into him. He fixed his gaze on the flickering depths of the fire. There, in that writhing inferno, he sought to forget his cares and responsibilities. But the constant motion of the flames soon lulled him into a passive state, where unrelated fragments of thoughts, sounds, images, and emotions drifted through him like snowflakes falling from a calm winter's sky. And amid that flurry there appeared the face of the soldier who had begged for his life. Again Aragorn saw him crying, and again he heard his desperate pleas, and again he felt how his neck snapped like a wet branch of wood. Tormented by the memories, Aragorn clenched his teeth and breathed hard through flared nostrils. Cold sweat sprang up over his entire body. He shifted in place and strove to dispel the soldier's unfriendly ghost, but to no avail.
"Go away!" he shouted. "It wasn't my fault. Galbatorix is the one you should blame, not me. I didn't want to kill you."
Somewhere in the darkness surrounding them, a wolf howled. From various locations across the plains a score of other wolves answered, raising their voices in a discordant melody. The eerie singing made Aragorn's scalp tingle and goosebumps break out in his arms. Then, for a brief moment, the howls coalesced into a single tone that was similar to the battle cry of a charging cull. Aragorn shifted, uneasy.
"What's wrong?" asked Arya. "Is it the wolves? They shall not bother us, you know. They are teaching their pups how to hunt, and they won't allow their younglings near creatures who smell as strangely as we do."
"It's not the wolves out there," said Aragorn, hugging himself.
"It's the wolves in here."
He tapped the middle of his forehead. Arya nodded, a sharp, bird-like motion that betrayed the fact she was not human, even though she had assumed the shape of one.
"It is always thus. The monsters of the mind are far worse than those that actually exist. Fear, doubt, and hate have hamstrung more people than beasts ever have."
"And love," he pointed out.
"And love," she admitted. "Also greed and jealousy, and every other obsessive urge the sentient races are susceptible to."
Aragorn thought of Tenga, alone in the ruined elf outpost of Edur Ithindra, hunched over his precious hoard of tomes, searching, always searching, for his elusive answer. He refrained from mentioning the hermit to Arya, for it was not in him to discuss that curious encounter at the present. Instead, he asked, "Does it bother you when you kill?" Arya's green eyes narrowed.
"Neither I nor the rest of my people eat the flesh of animals because we cannot bear to hurt another creature to satisfy our hunger, and you have the effrontery to ask if killing disturbs us? Do you really understand so little of us that you believe we are cold-hearted murderers?" "No, of course not," he protested. "That's not what I meant."
"Then say what you mean, and do not give insult unless it is your intention." Choosing his words with greater care now, Aragorn said, "I asked this of Rohan before we attacked Helgrind, or a question very like it. What I want to know is, how do you feel when you kill? How are you supposed to feel?" He scowled at the fire.
"Do you see the warriors you have vanquished staring back at you, as real as you are before me?"
Arya tightened her arms around her legs, her gaze pensive. A flame jetted upward as the fire incinerated one of the moths circling the camp.
"Ganga,"
she murmured, and motioned with a finger. With a flutter of downy wings the moth departed. Never lifting her eyes from the clump of burning branches, she said,
"9 months after I became an ambassador, my mother's only ambassador, if truth be told, I travelled from the Varden in Farthendur to the capital of Surda, which was still a new country in those days. Soon after my companions and I left the Beor Mountains, we encountered a band of roving Urgals. We were content to keep our swords in their sheaths and continue on our way, but as is their wont, the Urgals insisted on trying to win honour and glory to better their standing within their tribes. Our force was larger than theirs, for Weldon, the man who succeeded Brom as leader of the Varden, was with us, and it was easy for us to drive them off. That day was the first time I took a life. It troubled me for weeks afterward, until I realized I would go mad if I continued to dwell upon it. Many do, and they become so angry, so grief-ridden, they can no longer be relied upon. Or their hearts turn to stone, and they lose the ability to distinguish right from wrong. How did you come to terms with what you had done?" "I examined my reasons for killing, to determine if they were just. Satisfied they were, I asked myself if our cause was important enough to continue supporting it, even though it would probably require me to kill again. Then I decided that whenever I began to think of the dead, I would picture myself in the gardens of Teildari Hall. Did it work?"
Brushing her hair out of her face, she tucked it behind one round ear.
"It did. The only antidote for the corrosive poison of violence is finding peace within yourself. It is a difficult cure to obtain, but well worth the effort."
She paused and then added, "Breathing helps too.
Breathing? Slow, regular breathing, as if you were meditating. It is one of the most effective methods for calming yourself.
Following her advice, Aragorn began to consciously inhale and exhale, taking care to maintain a steady tempo and to expel all the air from his lungs with each breath. Within a minute, the knot inside his gut loosened, his frown eased, and the presence of his fallen enemies no longer seemed quite so tangible. The wolves howled again, and after an initial burst of trepidation, he listened without fear, for their baying had lost the power to unsettle him.
"Thank you," he said.
Arya responded with a gracious tilt of her chin. Silence reigned for a quarter of an hour until Aragorn said, "Urgles." He let the statement stand for a while, a verbal monolith of ambivalence.
"What do you think about Nasuada allowing them to join the Varden?"
Arya picked up a twig by the edge of her splayed dress and rolled it between her aquiline fingers, studying the crooked piece of wood as if it contained a secret.
"It was a courageous decision, and I admire her for it. She always acts in the best interests of the Varden, no matter what the cost may be."
"She upset many of the Varden when she accepted Nargajvarg's offer of support."
"And she won back their loyalty with the trial of the Long Knives. Nasuada is very clever when it comes to maintaining her position."
Arya flicked the twig into the fire.
"I have no love for Urgles, but neither do I hate them. Unlike the Razak, they are not inherently evil, merely over-fond of war. It is an important distinction, even if it can provide no consolation to the families of their victims. We elves have treated with Urgles before, and we shall again when the need arises. It is a futile prospect, however."
She did not have to explain why. Many of the scrolls Oromis had assigned Aragorn to read were devoted to the subject of Urgles, and one in particular, The Travels of Gnevaldorskald, had taught him that the Urgles' entire culture was based upon feats of combat. Male Urgles could only improve their standing by raiding another village, whether Urgle, human, elf, or dwarf mattered little, or by fighting their rivals one-on-one, sometimes to the death. And when it came to picking a mate, Urgle females refused to consider a ram eligible unless he had defeated at least three opponents. As a result, each new generation of Urgles had no choice but to challenge their peers, challenge their elders, and scour the land for opportunities to prove their valor. The tradition was so deeply ingrained, every attempt to suppress it had failed.
"At least they are true to who they are," mused Aragorn. "That's more than most humans can claim." "How is it," he asked, "that Durza was able to ambush you, Glenwing, and Faolin with Urgles? Didn't you have wards to protect yourself against physical attacks?" "The arrows were enchanted."
"Were the Urgles spellcasters, then?" Closing her eyes, Arya sighed and shook her head.
"No, it was some dark magic of Durza's invention. He gloated about it when I was in Gilead."
"I don't know how you managed to resist him for so long. I saw what he did to you."
It was not easy. I viewed the torments he inflicted on me as a test of my commitment, as a chance to demonstrate that I had not made a mistake, and I was indeed worthy of the Yahweh symbol. As such, I welcomed the ordeal."
"But still, even elves are not immune to pain. It's amazing you could keep the location of Ellesmere hidden from him all those months." A touch of pride colored her voice.
"Not just the location of Ellesmere, but also where I had sent Saphira's egg, my vocabulary in the ancient language, and everything else that might be of use to Galbatorix."
The conversation lapsed, and then Aragorn said,
"Do you think about it much? What you went through in Gilead?"
When she did not respond, he added,
"You never talk about it. You recount the facts of your imprisonment readily enough, but you never mention what it was like for you, nor how you feel about it now." "Pain is pain," she said. "It needs no description."
"True, but ignoring it can cause more harm than the original injury. No one can live through something like that and escape unscathed. Not on the inside, at least. Why do you assume I have not already confided in someone? Who? Does it matter? Arjihad, my mother, a friend in Ellesmere. Perhaps I am wrong, he said. But you do not seem that close to anyone. Where you walk alone, even among your own people. Arya's countenance remained impassive. Her lack of expression was so complete, Aragorn began to wonder if she would deign to respond, a doubt that had just transformed into conviction, when she whispered, "It was not always so." Alert, Aragorn waited without moving, afraid that whatever he might do would stop her from saying more. "Once I had someone to talk to, someone who understood what I was and where I came from. Once, he was older than I, but we were kindred spirits, both curious about the world outside our forest, eager to explore and eager to strike against Galbatorix. Neither of us could bear to stay and do Weldenvarden, studying, working magic, pursuing our own personal projects, when we knew the Dragon Killer, the Bane of the Riders, was searching for a way to conquer our race. He came to that conclusion later than I, decades after I assumed my position as ambassador, and a few years before Hefring stole Saphira's egg. But the moment he did, he volunteered to accompany me wherever Islanzadi's orders might take me. She blinked, and her throat convulsed. I wasn't going to let him, but the Queen liked the idea, and he was so very convincing. She pursed her lips and blinked again, her eyes brighter than normal. As gently as he could, Aragorn asked, "Was it Faelin?"
"Yes,"
she said, releasing the confirmation almost as a gasp. "Did you love him?" Casting back her head, Arya gazed up at the twinkling sky, her long neck gold with firelight, her face pale with the radiance of the heavens.
"Do you ask out of friendly concern, or your own self-interest?"
She gave an abrupt, choked laugh, the sound of water falling over cold rocks.
"Never mind. The night air has addled me. It has undone my sense of courtesy, and left me free to say the most spiteful things that occur to me."
"No matter."
"It does matter, because I regret it, and I shall not tolerate it. Did I love Faelin? How would you define love? For over 20 years we travelled together, the only immortals to walk among the short-lived races. We were companions and friends."
A pang of jealousy afflicted Aragorn. He wrestled with it, subdued it, and tried to eliminate it, but was not altogether successful. A slight remnant of the feeling continued to aggravate him like a splinter burrowing underneath his skin.
"Over 20 years,
repeated Arya. Persisting in her survey of the constellations, she rocked back and forth, seemingly oblivious to Aragorn.
"And then, in a single instant, Durza tore that away from me. Faelin and Glenwing were the first elves to die in combat for nearly a century. When I saw Faelin fall, I understood then that the true agony of war isn't being wounded yourself, it's having to watch those you care about being hurt. It was a lesson I thought I had already learned during my time with the Varden, when one after another the men and women I had come to respect died from swords, arrows, poison, accidents, and old age. The loss had never been so personal, however, and when it happened, I thought, now I must surely die as well. For whatever danger we had encountered before, Faelin and I had always survived it together, and if he could not escape, then why should I?"
Aragorn realized she was crying, thick tears rolling from the outer corners of her eyes, down her temples and into her hair. By the stars, her tears appeared like rivers of silvered glass. The intensity of her distress startled him. He had not thought it was possible to elicit such a reaction from her, nor had he intended to.
"Then Gilead,"
she said. Those days were the longest of my life. Phelan was gone. I did not know whether Saphira's egg was safe or if I had inadvertently returned her to Galbatorix. And Durza sated the bloodlust of the spirits that controlled him by doing the most horrible things he could imagine to me. Sometimes, if he went too far, he would heal me, so he could begin anew the following morning. If he had given me a chance to collect my wits, I might have been able to fool my jailer as you did, and avoid consuming the drug that kept me from using magic. But I never had more than a few hours' respite. Durza needed sleep no more than you or I, and he kept at me whenever I was conscious and his other duties permitted. While he worked on me, every second was an hour, every hour a week, and every day an eternity. He was careful not to drive me mad. Galbatorix would have been displeased with that. But he came close. He came very, very close. I began to hear birdsong where no birds could fly, and to see things that could not exist. Once, when I was in my cell, gold light flooded the room, and I grew warm all over. When I looked up, I found myself lying on a branch high in a tree, near the center of Ellesmere. The sun was about to set, and the whole city glowed as if it were on fire. The Æthelwald were chanting on the path below, and everything was so calm, so peaceful, so beautiful. I would have stayed there forever. But then the light faded, and I was again on my cot. I had forgotten, but once there was a soldier who left a white rose in my cell. It was the only kindness anyone ever showed me in Gilead. That night the flower took root and matured into a huge rosebush that climbed the wall, forced its way between the blocks of stone in the ceiling, breaking them, and pushed its way out of the dungeon and into the open. It continued to ascend until it touched the moon and stood as a great twisting tower that promised escape if I could but lift myself off the floor. I tried with every ounce of my remaining strength, but it was beyond me, and when I glanced away, the rosebush vanished. That was my state of mind when you dreamed of me, and I felt your presence hovering over me. Small wonder I disregarded the sensation as another delusion.
She gave him a wan smile.
And then you came, Aragorn. You and Saphira. After hope had deserted me and I was about to be taken to Galbatorix in Urubane, a rider appeared to rescue me. A rider and dragon.
And Morzan's son, he said. Both of Morzan's sons.
Describe it how you will. It was such an improbable rescue, I occasionally think that I did go mad, and that I've imagined everything since.
Would you have imagined me causing so much trouble by staying behind at Helgrind?
No, she said. I suppose not.
With the cuff of her left sleeve, she dabbed her eyes, drying them.
When I awoke in Farthendur, there was too much that needed doing for me to dwell on the past. But events of late have been dark and bloody, and increasingly I have found myself remembering that which I should not. It makes me grim and out of sorts, without patience for the ordinary delays of life.
She shifted into a kneeling position, and placed her hands on the ground on either side of her, as if to steady herself.
You say I walk alone. Elves do not incline toward the open displays of friendship humans and dwarves favor, and I have ever been of a solitary disposition. But if you had known me before Gilead, if you had known me as I was, you would not have considered me so aloof. Then I could sing and dance, and not feel threatened by a sense of impending doom.
Reaching out, Aragorn placed his right hand over her left.
The stories about the heroes of old never mention that this is the price you pay when you grapple with the monsters of the dark and the monsters of the mind. Keep thinking about the gardens of Teildari Hall, and I'm sure you will be fine.
Arya permitted the contact between them to endure for almost a minute, a time not of heat or passion for Aragorn, but rather of quiet companionship. He made no attempt to press his suit with her, for he cherished her trust more than anything besides his bond with Zafira, and he would sooner march into battle than endanger it. Then, with a slight lift of her arm, Arya let him know the moment had passed, and without complaint he withdrew his hand. Eager to lighten her burden however he could, Aragorn glanced about the ground nearest him, and then murmured, so softly as to be inaudible, "Loivissa." Guided by the power of the true name, he sifted through the earth by his feet until his fingers closed upon what he sought. A thin, papery disc half the size of his smallest fingernail. Holding his breath, he deposited it in his right palm, centering it over his Gedwe Ignazia with as much delicacy as he could muster. He reviewed what Oromis had taught him concerning the sort of spell he was about to cast to ensure he would not make a mistake, and then he began to sing after the fashion of the elves, smooth and flowing.
Eldrinnar Oloivissa Nuanen, Dotter Aberdeloi, Eldrinnar nen onno weonate medesolus untrinca, Eldrinnar unforte onor feon vara, Wiol alar sion, Eldrinnar Oloivissa Nuanen.
Again and again, Aragorn repeated the same four lines, directing them toward the brown flake in his hand. The flake trembled, and then swelled and bulged, becoming spherical. White tendrils, an inch or two long, sprouted from the bottom of the peeling globe, tickling Aragorn, while a thin green stem poked its way out of the tip, and at his urging, shot nearly a foot in the air. A single leaf, broad and flat, grew from the side of the stem. Then the tip of the stem thickened, drooped, and after a moment of seeming inactivity, split into five segments that expanded outward to reveal the waxy petals of a deep-throated lily. The flower was pale blue and shaped like a bell. When it reached its full size, Aragorn released the magic and examined his handiwork. Singing plants into shape was a skill most every elf mastered at an early age, but it was one Aragorn had practiced only a few times, and he had been uncertain whether his efforts would meet with success. The spell had exacted a heavy toll from him. The lily required a surprising amount of energy to feed what was the equivalent of a year and a half of growth. Satisfied with what he had wrought, he handed the lily to Arya. "It's not a white rose, but..." He smiled and shrugged.
"You should not have," she said. "But I am glad you did."
She caressed the underside of the blossom and lifted it to smell. The lines on her face eased. For several minutes she admired the lily. Then she scooped a hole in the soil next to her and planted the bulb, pressing down the soil with the flat of her hand. She touched the petals again and kept glancing at the lily as she said,
"Thank you. Giving flowers is a custom both our races share, but we elves attach greater importance to the practice than do humans. It signifies all that is good. Life, beauty, rebirth, friendship, and more. I explain so you understand how much this means to me. You did not know, but..."
"I knew." Arya regarded him with a solemn countenance, as if to decide what he was about.
"Forgive me. That is twice now I have forgotten the extent of your education. I shall not make the mistake again."
She repeated her thanks in the ancient language, and, joining her in her native tongue, Aragorn replied that it was his pleasure, and he was happy she enjoyed his gift. He shivered, hungry despite the meal they had just eaten. Noticing, Arya said,
"You used too much of your strength. If you have any energy left in Arryn, use it to steady yourself."
It took Aragorn a moment to remember that Arryn was the name of Brom's ring. He had heard it uttered only once before, from Isanzadi on the day he arrived in Ellesmere. "My ring now," he told himself. "I have to stop thinking of it as Brom's." He cast a critical gaze at the large sapphire that sparkled in its gold setting on his finger. I don't know if there is any energy in Arran. I've never stored any there myself, and I never checked if Brom had. Even as he spoke, he extended his consciousness toward the sapphire. The instant his mind came into contact with the gem, he felt the presence of a vast, swirling pool of energy. To his inner eye, the sapphire thrummed with power. He wondered that it did not explode from the amount of force contained within the boundaries of its sharp-edged facets. After he used the energy to wash away his aches and pains and restore strength to his limbs, the treasure trove inside Arran was hardly diminished. His skin tingling, Aragorn severed his link with the gem. Delighted by his discovery and his sudden sense of well-being, he laughed out loud, then told Arya what he had found. Brom must have squirreled away every bit of energy he could spare the whole time he was hiding in Carvajal. He laughed again, marveling. All those years! With what's in Arran, I could tear apart an entire castle with a single spell! He knew he would need it to keep the new rider safe when Saphira hatched, observed Arya. Also, I am sure Arran was a way for him to protect himself if he had to fight a Shade or some other similarly powerful opponent. It was not by accident that he managed to frustrate his enemies for the better part of a century. If I were you, I would save the energy he left you for your hour of greatest need, and I would add to it whenever I could. It is an incredibly valuable resource. You should not squander it. No, thought Aragorn, that I will not. He twirled the ring around his finger, admiring how it gleamed in the firelight. Since Murtagh stole Zarok, this Saphira's saddle and Snowfire are the only things I have of Brom. And even though the dwarves brought Snowfire from Farthendur, I rarely ride him nowadays. Arran is really all I have to remember him by. My only legacy of him. My only inheritance. I wish he was still alive. I never had a chance to talk with him about Oromis, Murtagh, my father. Oh, the list is endless. What would he have said about my feelings for Arya? Aragorn snorted to himself. I know what he would have said. He would have berated me for being a love-struck fool and for wasting my energy on a hopeless cause. And he would have been right, too, I suppose. But, oh, how can I help it? She is the only woman I wish to be with. The fire cracked. A flurry of sparks flew upward. Aragorn watched with half-closed eyes, contemplating Arya's revelations. Then his mind returned to a question that had been bothering him ever since the battle on the Burning Plains. Arya, do male dragons grow any faster than female dragons? No. Why do you ask? Because of Thorn. He's only a few months old, and yet he's already nearly as big as Saphira. I don't understand it. Picking a dry blade of grass, Arya began sketching in the loose soil, tracing the curved shapes of glyphs from the elf script, the Lidwyn Cavadi. Most likely Galvatorix accelerated his growth so Thorn would be large enough to hold his own with Saphira. Ah. Isn't that dangerous, though? Oromis told me that if he used magic to give me the strength, speed and endurance and other skills I needed, I would not understand my new abilities as well as if I had gained them in the ordinary way, by hard work. He was right, too. Even now, the changes the dragons made to my body during the Agaiti Blodron still sometimes catch me by surprise. Arya nodded, and continued sketching glyphs in the dirt. It is possible to reduce the undesirable side effects by certain spells, but it is a long and arduous process. If you wish to achieve true mastery of your body, it is still best to do so through normal means. The transformation Galvatorix has forced upon Thorn must be incredibly confusing for him. Thorn now has the body of a nearly grown dragon, and yet his mind is still that of a youngling. Aragorn fingered the newly formed calluses on his knuckles. Do you also know why Murtagh is so powerful? More powerful than I am? If I did, no doubt I would also understand how Galvatorix has managed to increase his own strength to such unnatural heights. But alas, I do not. But Oromis does, Aragorn thought. or at least the elf had hinted as much. However, he had yet to share the information with Aragorn and Saphira. As soon as they were able to return to Duweldenvarden, Aragorn intended to ask the Elder Rider